Hello, this is your Sin Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, April 22nd, 2026. And here are today's business headlines. Boeing's commercial jet business improves, reducing quarterly loss. The plane maker reported brisk first quarter commercial sales despite wiring flaws that delayed some deliveries. By Drew Fitzgerald. Best Buy CEO Corey Barry steps down after years of tepid growth. She'll be succeeded by Jason Bonfig, a longtime executive at the electronics retailer. By Sarah Nassauer. ABB shares rise on guidance. Lyft. Robust demand. The industrial technology company now expects comparable revenue growth in high single-digit to low double-digit percentage, up from the range of 6% to 9% by Nina Kinley. NFL makes its case to FCC during regulatory scrutiny. The league defended its media rights dealings as federal regulators investigate the migration to streaming by Joe Flint. Gates Foundation to cut 20% of staff, review Epstein files. The philanthropic giant plans to cut up to 500 jobs by 2030, the CEO said in a memo. T-Mobile and Germany's Deutsche Telekom Way combination. By Lauren Thomas and Patient Hagen. And our first article today is Boeing's commercial jet business improves, reducing quarterly loss. Plane maker reports brisk first quarter commercial sales despite wiring flaws that delayed some deliveries. By Drew Fitzgerald. Boeing's commercial jet production lines continued to gain steam in the first quarter, helping reduce the company's quarterly loss. The plane maker's sales jumped 14% from a year earlier to $22.2 billion, helped by its recovering passenger jet business and growth in its defense and space segment. Boeing turned over 143 planes to commercial clients in the quarter, a 10% increase despite a wiring issue that held up some 737 MAX jet deliveries. Overall, Boeing posted a $7 million loss for the 3 months ended March 31st, compared with the $31 million loss in the year earlier quarter. The loss was 11 cents on a per-share basis, compared with 16 cents on a year earlier. The results beat Wall Street's analysts' estimates, which on average predicted a net loss of 35 cents a share and sales of $21.9 billion, according to FactSet. The company still burned through $1.45 billion in the first quarter, a hangover from the stringent production caps that U.S. regulators imposed 2 years ago to address past quality control lapses. Production of the company's top-selling 737 MAX narrow-body jet has since grown to 42 planes a month as officials relax some limits. Boeing executives have said the company can stop bleeding cash before the end of this year by pumping out jets faster and more carefully managing military contracts that have led to ballooning costs in past years. A more ambitious $10 billion annual free cash flow target remains years away. Drew Fitzgerald is an aerospace and defense reporter for the Wall Street Journal in Washington. Best Buy CEO Corey Barry steps down after years of tepid growth. She'll be succeeded by Jason Bonfig, a longtime executive at the electronics retailer. By Sarah Nassauer. Best Buy Chief Executive Officer Corey Barry will leave the role later this year after the electronics retailer has reported years of tepid sales growth that weighed on its stock. Barry, who is 51 years old, will step down as CEO and as a member of the board at the end of October, the company said Wednesday. She'll be succeeded by Jason Bonfig, a longtime Best Buy executive who is currently the company's chief customer, product, and fulfillment officer. Bonfig, 49, first joined the retailer as an inventory analyst in 1999, then held a series of merchandising roles. He'll join the company's board once he becomes CEO later this year. Barry will stay on as a company advisor for 6 months after she steps down, the company said. When Barry took the helm in 2019, the electronics retailer had reversed its fortunes and defied the fate of other retailers who failed to fend off Amazon at the time, such as bankrupt Circuit City and Sports Authority. The following year, the board opened a probe into Barry, based on an anonymous letter they received that alleged she had a romantic relationship with a fellow senior executive. The board decided to keep her in her role and didn't disclose the findings of the investigation at the time. When the pandemic hit, Best Buy's sales soared as it benefited from more people working and schooling at home, buying up laptops and home entertainment systems. It wasn't stuck with excess inventory when that demand quickly receded, as some retail competitors were at the time. But in recent years, sales have been tepid. The company has implemented a series of layoffs and employee reorganizations in stores. It also worked to improve its stores and to expand its sales online, as well as grow through alternative businesses such as advertising. Barry skillfully guided the company through many external challenges, the company said in a release Wednesday. During Barry's tenure, the company's stock rose 6.25%, compared with a 157% increase for the S&P 500. Over the past 12 months, Best Buy's stock rose 7.2%. Analysts at Goldman Sachs recommended selling Best Buy's stock earlier this month, in part due to the risk of higher electronics prices as technology such as artificial intelligence leads to higher demand and therefore cost for memory chips that are used in items such as laptops. The company declined to comment on the downgrade. Last month, Barry said that the Best Buy is aware that increased demand for memory components is a challenge, and it is partnering with our vendors to mitigate impacts on the business. That includes bringing in inventory faster and giving vendors a longer sales forecast horizon, she said. The incoming CEO, Bonfig, currently oversees some of the company's growth efforts, such as its e-commerce and ad businesses, the company said. Best Buy doubled the number of ad partners it had in the most recent full year compared with the previous year, Barry said during the company's last quarterly earnings presentation. For the full year, the company expects comparable sales, those from stores or digital channels operating for at least a year, in a range between down 1% to up 1%, and total revenue of $41.2 billion to 41.1, a slight increase from last year. Sarah Nassauer writes about large retailers including Walmart, Target, Costco, Home Depot, and Dollar General for the Wall Street Journal's Corporate Bureau in New York. ABB shares rise on guidance, lift, robust demand. Orders amounted to a record high at $11.30 billion, boosted by comparable order growth on electrification. By Nina Kienle. ABB shares climbed after the company raised its sales guidance on a high order backlog and improved business performance despite risks from geopolitical uncertainties. Shares were up 3.2% at 76.62 Swiss francs after rising more than 5% at market open on Wednesday. The Swiss industrial technology company said it now expects comparable on-year revenue growth in a high single-digit to low double-digit percentage range. It previously targeted comparable revenue growth of 6% to 9%. ABB said its operational earnings before interest, taxes, and amortization margin continues to improve. This Middle East conflict adds uncertainty to the global trading climate, although to date, demand for our electrification and automation offerings has remained overall resilient and supportive to our raised ambitions for 2026, Chief Executive Officer Morten Wierod said. For the first quarter, ABB booked higher than net profit, revenue, and operational EBITDA, with corresponding margin improving to 23.5% from 30.3%. ABB said demand remained robust and orders hit a record high at $11.30 billion, boosted by comparable order growth in electrification. ABB's first quarter results confirm that its underlying operational momentum can improve even further with record-breaking order intake. RBC Capital Markets analysts Sebastian Cuny and Nick Housden said in a research note, ABB anticipates further acceleration of global data center demand, benefiting the electrification business. Wierod said in a conference call that he expects a move towards energy sourcing diversification that will benefit the group. There is a need for more energy resilience, he said. This is an opportunity for ABB, he added. Nina Kinley is a reporter covering EMEA financial news for Dow Jones, Newswires, and The Wall Street Journal. NFL makes its case to FCC during regulatory scrutiny. League defends media rights dealings as federal regulators investigate migration to streaming, by Joe Flint. As federal regulators scrutinize the migration of sports to streaming, the NFL is going on the offensive. Meeting last week with senior Federal Communications Commission's officials to justify the league's media rights strategy. The meeting Friday in Washington, which the NFL requested, came after the FCC started its probe into the changing sports media business and whether the evolution is harming consumers and the broadcast television industry. The meeting was described in the FCC filing Tuesday by the NFL. Separately, the Justice Department is investigating sports leagues' pivot to streaming and its impact on the marketplace. The FCC gathering included the league's top media executive, Hans Schroeder, who oversees how the NFL licenses games to its media partners. FCC Chairman Brendan Carr, who has made sports leagues a target in public comments, greeted the league officials before turning the meeting over to his top advisors. Schroeder's presentation to the FCC defended its 65-year-old antitrust exemption that allows it to negotiate media rights for all NFL teams. In one slide, the league argued that having 32 teams negotiate their own rights deals individually would result in further viewer confusion and higher costs. Sports leagues are selling more games to streaming services such as Netflix and Amazon.com's Prime Video, which are willing to pay a premium for the popular content. Viewers often express frustration at the challenges of keeping up with who is carrying what games and the added cost to watch them. The league has created streamed games including Amazon's Thursday Night Football and Netflix's Christmas Day Matches, and has moved some postseason playoff games to streaming. The NFL is currently shopping a package of 5 games that is expected to end up on streaming services, the Wall Street Journal has reported. Netflix is among the interested bidders. Many consumers today find it more difficult to find the events they want to watch and are now paying to sign up for one or more video distribution platforms that consumers can find difficult to navigate, the FCC said in a February notice, seeking comments from the industry and interested parties, including consumers. The agency said it is concerned that the move of more sports and ad dollars to streaming could inhibit the ability of local broadcast television stations to meet their public interest obligations, including their production of local news and reporting. In recent comments to the FCC, Fox Corp said making paywall streaming the default viewing option for live sports could have devastating consequences for consumers and broadcast stations alike. Fox and Journal parent News Corp share common ownership. While the NFL is selling more games to streaming services, Schroeder said pro football remains the most fan-friendly sport in part because most of its matchups are available through free over-the-air television. In its presentation, the league said 87% of its games are primarily distributed on broadcast TV through CBS, NBC, Fox, and ABC, as has long been the case. Facts are stubborn things, Schroeder said in an interview. Per NFL policy, when games are shown on streaming services or cable channels, they're also available in the local TV markets of the teams playing. Even as we've gone on to new platforms like Netflix or Amazon, we are doing so in a very selective and appropriate way, Schroeder said. The Justice Department's separate probe is particularly focused on whether sports leagues are engaging in anti-competitive practices when selling rights, the journal has reported. Charlie Beller, acting Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, addressed the topic of antitrust enforcement in a shifting media landscape at an industry conference Monday. The key antitrust question is whether the process by which those prices are set remains competitive, he said. Joe Flint is a media and entertainment reporter for the Wall Street Journal, based in the Los Angeles bureau covering everything from broadcast networks and sports to cable and streaming. Gates Foundation to cut 20% of staff, review Epstein ties. Philanthropic giant plans to cut up to 500 jobs by 2030, CEO says in memo by Emily Glazer. The Gates Foundation is cutting up to 500 jobs, or roughly 20% of its staff, over the next several years. And the philanthropic giant has also opened an external review of its ties with the late Jeffrey Epstein. The foundation shared details on the moves Tuesday in an email to staff that was reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The foundation and its co-founder, Bill Gates, have been reeling from disclosures about the Microsoft billionaire's association with Epstein. Earlier this year, Gates apologized at a town hall for having affairs with two women and said he regretted his association with Epstein and that he didn't participate in the sex offenders' crimes. He has been called to testify about his Epstein ties before Congress in June. This is a challenging time for our organization in many ways, but it also highlights the critical importance of taking the tough actions now, Gates Foundation CEO Mark Sussman wrote in the memo. The foundation had previously shared some information on job reductions in January, tied to its 2026 budget of about $9 billion, with plans to cap operating expenses at $1.25 billion. That would require reducing its workforce by up to 500 positions by 2030. In the first phase of the restructuring, the organization plans to reduce its current staff of 2,375 by 200 by the end of 2027, according to the memo. The organization is also looking to reduce spending on travel and other expenses. A foundation spokesperson confirmed the restructuring details shared in the memo. Along with the restructuring, Sussman said that he had commissioned in February an external review related to the foundation's engagement with Epstein and policies for vetting and developing new philanthropic partnerships. The review is underway, and the foundation expects to receive an update in the summer, the memo said. In a later statement, the foundation said the review was launched in March with the support of Gates, its chairman, and independent board members. Sussman told employees that a recent board meeting in London included a session on the impact of the Justice Department's Epstein files and how they relate to the foundation's work and reputation. The foundation, which has an $86 billion endowment, is focused on global health and development in Africa, including childhood mortality and infectious diseases. It is to sunset in 2045. Two of its biggest backers, Melinda French Gates and billionaire Warren Buffett, have left the board in recent years following the announcement of the Gates divorce. Buffett, in a recent CNBC interview, said there was a lot he didn't know about Gates and Epstein and that he hadn't spoken to Gates since the Epstein revelations came to light. Buffett, who has given about $43 billion to the foundation from 2006 to 2024, indicated he may not give it more money. His gifts usually are announced in June. Emily Glazer is a Pulitzer Prize-winning enterprise reporter focusing on business leaders, power, and influence for the Wall Street Journal in New York. U.S.-Iran delay talks in high-stakes game of chicken. The White House paused plans to send Vice President J.D. Vance to Pakistan after Tehran held its negotiators back at the last minute. By Summer Said, Lawrence Norman, Alexander Ward, and Natalie Andrews. As negotiations with Iran broke down Tuesday, before they had even begun, President Trump asked aides whether the U.S. should resume attacks on the country, according to the U.S. officials. Just hours earlier, White House officials had been optimistic that Vice President J.D. Vance, set to depart for Islamabad Tuesday, would be able to strike a deal with Iran and get something in writing. Unlike his trip to Pakistan 2 weeks prior, a U.S. official said. Air Force Two sat idle most of the day at Joint Base Andrews in suburban Washington awaiting Vance. Pakistani mediators said Iran's top leaders had told them earlier that their negotiating team would also travel to Islamabad on Tuesday. Then, with the clock ticking toward Trump's ceasefire deadline, Iran reversed course. In a series of frenzied meetings throughout the day at the White House, Trump weighed his options with Vance, top security officials, as well as his son-in-law Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, who were also supposed to depart Tuesday for Islamabad for negotiations. By early afternoon, Vance's trip was paused. By evening, it was delayed indefinitely. During the meetings, aides told Trump that Iran's government wasn't a unified entity, and hardline factions in Tehran unwilling to bend to the president's demands. Questions were raised at the White House about whether Iran was really even in a position to negotiate and stick to any commitments. Even as Trump asked about resuming the bombing campaign, officials said he seemed wary about restarting hostilities and prolonging a conflict that is deeply unpopular with the American public. Trump and his team split the difference, maintain pressure on Iran indefinitely until they make a concrete offer to the U.S. After that, the president could gauge whether negotiations could proceed or if he would have to order a new wave of strikes on the Islamic Republic. Trump said in a social media post Tuesday that he would maintain the blockade and extend the ceasefire, which was set to expire Wednesday, as long as talks continue. Vance could still leave later in the week, but Trump is privately discussing canceling the trip altogether, a U.S. official said. The high-stakes game of chicken complicated the effort to negotiate an end to a conflict that has left thousands dead and sent shudders through the global economy. Delaying tactics aren't uncommon in negotiations, where every detail can be a source of leverage. But mediators said Tehran's last-minute curveball this time reflected its anger at the week-old American blockade of its ports and an effort by the government's hardliners to extract the highest possible price to end the war. The U.S. military raised the pressure on Iran Tuesday by boarding a sanctioned crude oil tanker in the Indian Ocean, part of an effort to crack down on ships in the so-called shadow fleet that help Iran evade sanctions. Tehran went into the first round of talks earlier in April, confident that its grip on the Strait of Hormuz and the ability of its drones and missiles to inflict economic pain on the Gulf and global economy had given it leverage in the talks. The largely effective U.S. blockade, which took effect 24 hours after the first round ended without a deal, has chipped away at Tehran's advantage. "I think it levels the scales of pressure between the U.S. and Iran," Michael Singh, a former senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, who is now at the Washington Institute think tank, said of the blockade. Previously, Iran was exporting oil and no one else was, which meant time and pressure were working against Washington. Iran's new leaders, while desperately in need of sanctions relief to rebuild the country after more than 20,000 U.S. and Israeli airstrikes, are aiming to show that they can withstand the economic pain and outlast the U.S. in the war. Many Iranian officials saw the decision to end fighting so quickly in last June's 12-day war as a strategic mistake. That view became more entrenched as the U.S. tightened the economic screws after the war, deepening a crisis that had led to protests that shook the regime in January. Iran dragged things out going into the first round of talks as well, saying it wouldn't join without a ceasefire in Lebanon. The talks went ahead anyway, without a truce on that front, but the White House did ultimately deliver one day later. This time, Iran's hardline leadership, which has publicly proclaimed that it won't negotiate under pressure, couldn't easily greenlight the talks while the U.S. is actively bottling up its ports, the mediator said. "Blockading Iranian ports is an act of war and thus a violation of the ceasefire," Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said on social media. "Striking a commercial vessel and taking its crew hostage is an even greater violation." In Islamabad, the city was ready and waiting for a meeting that is now uncertain. The airport road was heavily manned with armed guards in pickup trucks, and soldiers sat around town on plastic chairs. Authorities requisitioned three luxury hotels, but shops remained open, unlike during the first round of talks. The owner of a convenience store at a fuel station said he lost 20% of his weekly business, or more than $20,000 during the shutdown, but wouldn't mind shutting again to support an important role for the country. While Trump has said he is ready to get back to fighting, he has repeatedly backed away from threats to hit Iran's power plants and other key infrastructure. Earlier, he appeared to add an extra day to the ceasefire, which had initially been expected to end on Tuesday. The pressure from markets has eased with the ceasefire in place. The S&P 500 stock index has been higher than it was before the war, and the rise in oil prices has been blunted. Iran's daily drone and missile attacks on Gulf oil producers have ended as well. The official Telegram account of Iranian Supreme Leader Mujtaba Khamenei published threats late Tuesday to attack U.S. and Israeli forces, but so far the ceasefire has held. Despite high levels of mistrust on both sides and big gaps in their bottom lines, mediators and other people familiar with the talks say the two foes have been engaging with ideas that could point to possible compromises around core issues like Iran's nuclear program. The two sides are getting closer to a framework that would include a basic understanding on curbing Iran's uranium enrichment, what to do with enriched uranium stockpiles, and reopening the strait, people familiar with the matter said. Iran often deploys long waits to keep people guessing until the next minute, said Mohammad Armarsi, an Iran expert and member of the Global Advisory Council of the Wilson Center, a Washington think tank. The blockade cuts into Iran's ability to use the Strait of Hormuz as a bargaining chip and could over time put pressure on the regime to ease its negotiating position. Some analysts believe that a fully enforced blockade could strip Iran of almost $300 million in daily export revenue and disrupt the imports needed to keep its economy going. Others say it will take longer to bite, while Iran's own closure of the Strait of Hormuz squeezes global oil supplies. This is a leverage-seeking exercise, pure and simple, said Benram Ben Teleblu, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a Washington think tank which has opposed Iran's regime. In the short term, it signals U.S. commitment, which is important, and this is as much of a war of wills as it is one of energy and security. U.S. forces have directed 28 vessels to turn around or return to port since the blockade of Iranian ports began on April 13th, said U.S. Central Command, which oversees the U.S. military in the Middle East. Singh warned that the blockade could prove a double-edged sword for Washington at a time when the blockade of the Strait of Hormuz is hurting the world economy and driving up U.S. energy prices ahead of November's midterm elections. The blockade is a bet that Iran will break before the rest of the world will, but it's a risky bet, he said. The Iranian regime is fighting for its survival and has demonstrated an ability to withstand the strangulation of its oil exports. Samer Said is a correspondent covering energy in Saudi Arabia from the Wall Street Journal's Middle East Bureau. Lawrence Norman is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Alexander Ward is a national security reporter covering the White House and State Departments for the Wall Street Journal in Washington. Natalie Andrews is a White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal covering domestic policy and President Trump's legislative agenda. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones, and you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. No peace plan, no problem. Why the wartime market keeps rising. Bad news stirs even greater interest among investors who see only prospects for the stock market to keep setting records. By Hannah Aaron Lang and David Uberti. Days after the U.S. and Israel attack on Iran, Anthony Reed was at home in Dallas wondering whether a doomsday energy shock for the global economy was precisely the time to make a big bet. Reed stared at his phone and considered plowing a chunk of his savings into shares of Robinhood. He had reasons to hold off. First of all, it would be a lot of money for a 30-year-old Amazon delivery driver new to investing. Second, a historic oil disruption from a war in Iran could turbocharge inflation and hammer stocks. Reed, the father of two boys, had also heard that the best time to invest was when others were scared off. He decided to click buy. There are times when bad news is bad news for markets. There are times when bad news is good news for markets. Then there are times like this, when bad news doesn't even register for investors, including Reed. From day traders to hedge funds, investors are once again running full speed into stocks and loading up on risk. A skeptic could find plenty cause for gloom. Oil tankers still can't freely traverse the Strait of Hormuz. The two sides are still trading threats when the next round of U.S.-Iran peace talks was put on pause. President Trump said Tuesday he would extend the ceasefire, but the U.S. would continue to blockade Iranian ports. Yet, the three major U.S. stock indexes have marched back to pre-war levels and then some. The tech industry's Magnificent Seven gained a $2.5 trillion in the market value over a recent 8-day stretch. Speculative bets are back. Allbirds, the one-time footwear favorite of techno-optimists in the 2010s, gained almost 600% in one day last week after pivoting to, what else, AI. Doubters warn that markets are increasingly driven by you-only-live-once bets and momentum-chasing algorithms, and as a result are getting dislocated from reality, or at least oblivious to bad news. A flood of information has left even the biggest traders struggling to parse fact from fiction. At the same time, Wall Street is confident that markets are a constraint on Trump, that he will do what he needs to reverse a sell-off, even if that means walking back a social post from the day before. Grizzled investors say the run-up merely confirms the age-old wisdom of keeping money in markets through turbulence. Near-term threats pale in comparison to a U.S. economy that has weathered crisis after crisis in recent years, often with help from Washington. America's massive oil and gas output also shields the U.S. economy from the shocks that boosted inflation and slowed growth in the 1970s. The market's current leap to new records reflects the same impulse to buy the dip that propelled stocks during the COVID-19 pandemic and last year's tariff turmoil. Four of the S&P 500's five biggest daily gains of this year have come during the war. For many traders, including Reed, when stocks go down, it's time to buy more stock. After sliding for much of March, Reed's Robinhood shares surged 31% in a single week. If stocks fell again, he said, I would dump more money into the market. It's a risky game. Even after peace prevails and ship traffic resumes through the Persian Gulf, many analysts believe energy prices will be higher for the rest of the year, and that a new era of conflict and economic nationalism could plague markets beyond that. We're not smart enough to know if that's going to happen or if that's not going to happen, said Matthew McLennan, a portfolio manager at First Eagle Investments. But it is apparent to me that markets aren't worried about that right now. Sean Lambert, global head of DV Commodities, one of the largest oil derivatives traders in the world, noticed taco emojis piling up, roughly 106 weeks in an internal Slack channel where his team tries to keep up with the fire hose of news. It's a nod to the dynamic even seasoned traders say matters most. The idea that Trump backs off his harshest plans, also known as Trump always chickens out, the taco trade. After the U.S. and Israel struck Iran in late February, stocks' wild swings took their cues from the oil market. Prices became an extension of the battle between a White House trying to tamp down energy costs and an Iranian regime attempting to do the opposite. Officials on both sides wage information warfare with conflicting social media posts. At the Manhattan office of DV Commodities, not far from West Village dining spots, long days have blurred together for traders at desks bathed in the light of six computer screens. Millions can ride on price swings of derivatives linked to the global spanning supply chains for oil, fuel, natural gas, and more. Lambert can see the impact on his team's profits and losses figuring in real time on his phone. A frenzied 31% run-up in oil prices after futures markets opened one Sunday night amounted to a bigger move in a matter of hours than traders might see in many years. A Trump post or ceasefire news have occasionally sent prices plunging, sometimes providing easy trading opportunities for DV. Even when things are working in your favor, it still feels uncomfortable, Lambert said. When trading, it doesn't matter if something is real or fake, he said. Whatever the price is doing, that's your main input. Real and fake in terms of information, who knows? Oil traders tend to thrive on volatility that upends markets and threatens economies overnight. But that same uncertainty has left even investors far afield of the energy industry, parsing feeds of oil tanker traffic and U.S. troop movements. One research firm even sent an analyst, armed with cash and Cuban cigars, to see the Strait of Hormuz up close. We've probably ingested more third-party qualitative analysis in the last 6 weeks than we have in our entire history combined, Lambert said. You have to understand what everyone else is thinking. That has contributed to a dynamic where momentum is hard to bet against, even though ship traffic through the Strait remains at a trickle, and oil stockpiles around the world are quickly falling. As prices retreated last week during the ceasefire between Washington and Tehran, Lambert said liquidity and trading volumes also fell, an apparent pullback from risk and a sign of market fatigue. We go into the end of last week, and everyone decides everything is back to normal again, he said, even though we're putting a bunch of highly reactive elements into a bottle and shaking them up. Benchmark global oil futures jumped 9% this week to $98.48 a barrel, while peace talks were in limbo. Wall Street traders learned an important lesson when Trump's tariff policies briefly upended global markets last year, dragging equities to double-digit losses in a matter of days. Some, like Alonso Munoz, the chief investment officer at Hamilton Capital Partners, viewed it as a clearance sale and bought up stock. He scored a big when Trump reversed his tariff stance and the markets ripped. Munoz saw the same dynamic developing in the Iran war. On a Monday in mid-March, he stared out at the Manhattan skyline from his office on the 85th floor and decided he didn't want to miss out on another blistering rally. This feels like Liberation Day, he told clients. His firm snapped up tens of millions of dollars worth of stocks, including Tesla, Amazon, and Oracle. This administration is willing to pivot when the market gets shaky, Munoz said. There was just no way that they were going to let this market get into trouble. As Trump's rhetoric effectively beat down short-term surges in oil, investors came to live with the prospect of higher-for-longer energy costs, even as consumer surveys showed a plunge in the economic outlook of Americans. Big banks reported blockbuster earnings this month, and Wall Street's top executives signaled the show would go on. After all three major U.S. indexes fell more than 7% from the start of the war, pushing the Dow and NASDAQ into correction territory, they've since boomeranged higher than when the drones and missiles started flying. Fuel-hungry transportation stocks bounced in a sign of growing industrial output. Beleaguered software shares and private credit firms rebounded. When the rally kicked off in recent days, data indicated it was more about technical trading strategies than confidence that the war was ending. Hedge funds, which had bet against the market as volatility climbed, started rapidly unwinding those short positions by buying up shares. There's an old Wall Street saying that nothing changes sentiment like price, and soon the rally was gaining steam. Professional investors grew more optimistic, buoyed by the approach of first quarter earnings season. Analysts were still projecting double-digit profit growth, making cheaper shares look like a bargain. Trend-following hedge funds went on a buying spree, adding to the momentum. The past 6 weeks have been a masterclass in how emotions and crowd behavior can drive breathtaking market swings, said Mark Hackett, chief market strategist for the Nationwide. Technical rallies have their limitations, and a shift of investor attention to fundamentals is needed to sustain the rally. Munoz says his investors seem less troubled by the swings than before. As stocks fell during the end of March, his phone remained surprisingly silent. Clients have gotten used to these sharp dips, he said. Some investors relish them, When Danner Drake, 54, saw news of the NASDAQ correction flash on his office computer in March 26th, he opened his brokerage app. Almost reflexively, the Alabama-based civil engineer sold roughly 10% of his holdings in a plain vanilla index fund and plugged it into ProShares UltraPro QQQ, a leveraged exchange-traded fund that promises triple the return, positive or negative, of the NASDAQ 100. After tapping the brakes in March, individual investors such as Drake started buying again in April, juicing gains in popular names including Palantir, Microsoft, and Robinhood. The activity echoed the dynamics of last summer's meme stock rally. Vanda Research global macro strategist Viraj Patel wrote in a note to clients. But Drake tries to get in early if he can, right after major indexes suffer a steep drop. For years, it's been his strategy. Take on some leverage, wait for the bounce, and collect the gains when the stocks snap back. A longtime investor who held on during the dot-com crash and the 2007-09 recession, Drake said his experience has instilled a kind of blind faith in the American stock market's ability to recover from just about any crisis. Why are the markets racing back to records? I have no idea, he said. It doesn't matter why it goes down, the Iran war, COVID, whatever, Drake said. All these times when the market drops, it doesn't even matter to me. I buy more. Hannah Aaron Lang is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in New York, where she covers financial markets with a focus on retail investing and brokerages. David Uberti is a reporter in New York covering the intersection of financial markets and the economy for the Wall Street Journal. Why gasoline is so much cheaper in the U.S. than overseas? Even as prices at the pump have remained elevated, American consumers are paying less than many of their counterparts in Europe and Asia. By Chow Ding and Alana Hype. The war in Iran has lifted U.S. gasoline prices to more than $4 a gallon, the highest average price in 4 years. Yet a U.S. price are still lower than they are in Germany, South Korea, and most other developed countries. The U.S. produces more oil than any nation in the world, and far more than it did during the oil crisis of the 1970s. So it is more insulated from global supply shocks than many nations are. Americans are sensitive to gas prices. The average American drives 1,300 miles a year, according to the federal government. Yet for years, U.S. consumers have paid lower gas prices than consumers in many other nations. Much of the discrepancy owes to taxes. According to S&P Global Energy, the U.S. government charges one of the lowest rates in the world. American consumers paid an average of $3.64 a gallon in March, with only about 60 cents of that made up of federal and state taxes. The average hit $4 a gallon at the end of that month. In most places in Europe, tax comprises 50 to 60% of the retail price of fuel. According to Rob Smith, S&P's energy director of global fuel retail. Germans paid an average of $8.75 a gallon in March, more than half of which stemmed from value-added taxes and fuel excise duties. In Mexico, gas averaged $5.07 a gallon in March, of which nearly $2 was tax. Mexicans near the U.S. border often fill up their gas tanks in El Paso and Brownsville in Texas to take advantage of cheaper rates there. While the U.S. primarily channels fuel taxes into maintaining roads and highways, other countries have historically used it for that and much more, from funding public transportation systems to government spending at large, according to S&P's Smith. Only more recently have states like California added carbon and environmental-related charges and regulations on gasoline to discourage use of fossil fuels. Such policies still remain limited in the U.S. and generally less extensive than those in Europe. Chow Ding is a New York-based reporter for the Wall Street Journal. covering the U.S. economy. Alana Pipe is a graphics editor at the Wall Street Journal, specializing in data visualization and interactive web graphics. And now from the editorial board, we have Oncologists versus the FDA and RFK Jr. Doctors who treat melanoma are shocked by a drug's rejection, by the editorial board. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. doesn't like our criticism of the Food and Drug Administration's rejection of Replimune's life-saving drug for metastatic melanoma. But the Health and Human Services Secretary's statements at a House hearing last Thursday were as bewildering as the FDA rejection. Every panel within FDA, all the career panels, the career scientists who looked at that drug said it was not effective, he said. That isn't true. The initial panel that reviewed Primeline's RPI-recommended approval, it was overruled by the FDA Biologics Chief Vinay Prasad. After an uproar among oncologists, the FDA last fall agreed to reconsider RPI and selected a second panel to eliminate what is called a bias. Dr. Prasad believed the first panel was biased because it recommended the drug, so he tapped new reviewers who shared his bias against the drug. But even those reviewers didn't say the drug wasn't effective. The FDA rejection letter instead said it is unclear whether the drug was effective based on contrived reasoning that Mr. Kennedy parroted. Replimune only did a one-arm trial, and all the people who were tested also received a chemotherapy drug, so we don't know what the effect was, Mr. Kennedy said. Fact check, no patients in the trial received chemotherapy. They were given the RPI onclotic virus therapy, in addition to an anti-PD-1 immunotherapy that is the first-line melanoma treatment. However, the cancer had worsened for all patients in the trial on an anti-PD-1 immunotherapy. It wouldn't have thus been unethical to give some patients an anti-PD-1 drug alone, merely to serve as a control group. RPI was given in combination with an anti-PD-1 drug because its aim is to activate the immune response, and in doing so, to overcome resistance to other immunotherapies. FDA reviewers would have understood all this had they consulted melanoma doctors who tell us the RPI rejection makes no sense and will cost thousands of lives. Anna Pavlik, a doctor at New York's Weill Cornell Medicine, who has researched melanoma for 25 years, treated patients in the trial. Honestly, there's no doubt in our minds whatsoever when we completed the study and saw the results that this was going to be approved as a wonderful alternative for our patients because they have no options, she tells us. She says cancer will eventually advance in about 60% of metastatic patients who are on a first-line anti-PD-1 drug. Doctors typically then give a checkpoint inhibitor or targeted drug if patients have a particular mutation, but many still continue to show cancer progression. At that point, their options are chemotherapy, which is rarely effective, or to enroll in a trial for an experimental treatment. Lord knows I've given enough chemotherapy in my lifetime to melanoma patients to know how dismal that outcome is, Mr. Pavlik says. Remarkably, a third of patients who fail to respond to a standard anti-PD-1 regimen went into remission with RPI-1. I have patients who have been treated with this drug that are still alive today and who would otherwise be dead, she says. The FDA claimed the anti-PD-1 drug, not RPI-1, might have been the reason patients went into remission. That's ludicrous, Dr. Pavlik says. These are patients that hands down progressed on anti-PD-1. She calls FDA's demand for a control group completely unethical, since they're progressing on that treatment. That is, their cancer is getting worse. Melanoma doctors were all pretty horrified with the rejection the first time around, she adds. But they figured that with further analysis and answering the FDA's questions, it would surely be approved. Melanoma doctors organized and sent a letter to the FDA imploring it to approve RP1. Pharma didn't ask us to do that, she says. We were all floored that it did not get approved the first time, that we felt we needed to do anything humanly possible to try to get this approved for our patients. By banding together, she says, we hoped their voices would be heard at the FDA, which in fact, obviously, they were not. Eric Whitman, a melanoma doctor at the Atlantic Health System Cancer Care, echoed her view on RP1's rejection. He has treated several patients with RP1 under the FDA's Expanded Access Program. The program lets doctors petition the FDA and a drug maker to prescribe an experimental medicine outside of a clinical trial. Dr. Whitman says cancer had worsened on every available treatment one of his patients had tried, including other experimental ones in clinical trials, but went into remission with RP1. When you talk to the melanoma experts, people who treat lots and lots of melanoma patients like myself, it's obvious that this is beneficial to patients and it's saving lives, or it has potential to save lives, he says. The community of patients and doctors don't understand the reasoning. Erin Pazor of Center Rapids, Iowa, received RP1 in the trial after her cancer worsened on an anti-PD-1 drug. After 8 rounds of treatment with RP1, she's been cancer-free since February 2023. She was able to work full-time as a physical therapist during her treatment because side effects were minimal. It's unfortunate that others won't have access to such a life-changing medication, she says. Mr. Kennedy said at the hearing that FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry made the correct decision to not approve that drug and was getting flack because he's trying to do change. Denying patients a life-saving medicine for inexplicable reasons is the wrong kind of change. If Mr. McCarry doesn't understand that, the FDA needs to change in leadership. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.